From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Amazing new information on what the cops involved in the Amadou Diallo shooting were doing just hours before. We'll also go live to their trial in Albany. And we'll speak with Joyce Horman, widow of American journalist Charles Horman, killed by Pinochet's men in 1973. New documents indicate key U.S. involvement in his murder. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Britain's High Court yesterday ordered the release of a medical report that found former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet unfit to stand trial, ruling that British Interior Minister Jack Straw was wrong in blocking it. The former dictator has been under house arrest in London since October 98. The court said the report should be released in strict confidentiality to the countries that are seeking to extradite him to face charges of torture and murder committed during his brutal 17-year rule. The report was leaked to two right-wing newspapers in Spain, which today quoted it as saying that Pinochet has suffered brain damage and would have trouble understanding and answering questions at a trial, though it also concludes that he's physically capable of facing prosecution. The information was leaked to the publications. Meanwhile, documents released by the U.S. government for the first time make clear that two Americans killed in Chile shortly after the CIA-backed coup in 73 were killed by Pinochet forces, and further speculated that the Chileans would not have done so without a green light from American intelligence. Charles Horman's and Frank Teruggi's disappearance and deaths were dramatized in the movie Missing. We're joined on the phone now by Joyce Horman, widow of journalist, human rights activist Charles Horman. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Joyce.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about the significance of these documents and what they say?
Well, the significance certainly is twofold. Number one, the State Department investigators concluded way back in the end of the late 70s that the circumstances surrounding Charles's death and U.S. knowledge of it merited additional investigation because there was circumstantial evidence, and as they put it, to suggest that the U.S. intelligence agencies had had a role in the death of Charles Horman, an unfortunate one, I think they euphemized. The fact that they made that conclusion in the late 70s, which was what our conclusion was, is very significant. The fact that they withheld it from us for all these years, 20-some years, is a personal and grave injustice, because had we known back then that they did agree with us about this investigation, we would have had more to go on in our case against the State Department, against Kissinger et al., with regard to getting information that we felt the U.S. did know about Charles's death.
And in fact, the embassy lied to you and lied to the family, saying that he may have been kidnapped by leftists. How do you feel about that now, the realization that the embassy directly lied?
Well, frankly, having been there, I knew it was a lie when I heard it first. What I think now is that there is an opportunity with the change of government in Chile for us to go back and say, please help us determine and come out with an official statement from Chile regarding the death of Charles Horman in 1973. Obviously, what was released back then was a lie, and it was not challenged by the Nixon-Kissinger administration. So I think now is the time to go back and ask for an official examination of those facts.
Joyce Horman, we only have a minute, but Captain Ray Davis, the chief of the U.S. military group at the American Embassy, who'd been making his weekly visit to the naval station, picked up your husband, your late husband, Charles Horman, and brought him back to Santiago. He just was giving him a ride. Is it true, this according to the New York Times article this weekend, that U.S. military man then took the registration card of Horman from the hotel, it appears, and gave it over to the military, the Pinochet military?
You know, the documents that the New York Times had privy to, I am not recollecting directly, but I know that he went to look at those cards. I know that he ordered that they be picked up. But I don't have the documents in front of me that were being referred to by the New York Times.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Joyce Horman, we're going to certainly follow the story, because as this information comes out under the Freedom of Information Act, we will get more information not only on your late husband, Charles Horman, but on, I believe, obviously other Americans, but most importantly, thousands of Chileans who died under Pinochet's rule. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Ni por tener buen amor, canto porque la guitarra tiene sentido y razón. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Officer Kenneth Boss testified yesterday. We brought you some of that testimony live during Democracy Now! From the trial in Albany. He said that he thought Amadou Diallo was crouched in a combat stance when he and three other officers fired 41 bullets at the unarmed African immigrant on February 4th of 1999. Testifying in his own defense in the murder trial, Boss appeared to be offering an explanation for why the officers continued firing at Amadou. On Monday, another of the police officers, Sean Carroll, said he mistakenly believed Diallo was wearing a bulletproof vest and kept firing at his legs. Richard Murphy, the last of the four officers to testify, did not speak of a crouch or combat stance, but said Diallo, who was standing in the vestibule of his Bronx apartment building, had his left arm up over his eyes and his right hand extended out toward the officers. Murphy said he believed Diallo had a gun in his right hand. Boss and Murphy, who followed officers Carroll and Edward McMillan in giving their accounts publicly for the first time, were cross-examined for just 20 minutes each by prosecutor Donald Levin, who asked them almost identical questions. Juan, you were at the trial this week.
Yes, Amy, and I was amazed by several things. One was the remarkable similarity of the testimony of each of the all of the officers said they thought they saw a gun. Not just one officer, but all of them thought they saw a gun, which is amazing at the same time, given that they were also insisted, all of them, that the area was dimly lit, that if there was a light in the vestibule, it was a very dim light. But they all claimed in that vestibule from outside, they all saw Mr. Diallo with what they believed to be a gun. And I was also somewhat taken aback by the prosecution's inability to pin down what the officers were doing for about 2.5 to 3 hours while on tour before they actually came onto Wheeler Avenue. And as we're discovering now, as we've discovered today, some amazing new information is beginning to come to light about what the four officers in this street crimes unit squad were doing before they arrived on Wheeler Avenue. And it's amazing that this has not come up at all in this trial.
That's right. We have on the line with us attorney Jose Muniz, and he is representing some young clients who were confronted by two street crimes units. First, street crimes unit was not Carroll and et al. Those are the four officers on trial now for the murder of Diallo. But then they came as backup to an incident that occurred just hours before. Jose Muniz, thank you for being with us.
Yes, good morning.
Well, can you tell us about what exactly took place just a couple hours before Diallo was killed?
Well, the two brothers, Antoine and Maurice Washington. Antoine Washington was around the corner from where he lives on Boynton Avenue. And he had a cell phone, and he was speaking on the cell phone, walking to the corner, turning on to where he lives. And a street crime unit vehicle rolled up, and yelled to him, hey, come over here, something to that effect. He didn't know who they were, and he continued walking and picked up pace as he entered where he lives. He goes up the stairs. It's similar to the Diallo building where there's a front door and then the vestibule with another door. They rushed him, tackled him in his own home, and he basically put up a fight. He didn't know who these people were. His mother then hears what's going on and comes down, and he's, you know, being attacked, basically attacked in his own home by officers, you know, plain clothes. His brother is coming home from the train station, observes a big...
And his brother's name is?
Is Maurice Washington, and sees a big gathering in front of his home, and he's not sure what's going on. So as he approaches, he realizes they're in his house. He rushes up and hears his brother screaming, hears his mother yelling, and he rushes up, and the cops tackle him and attack him for entering his own home. And it's our client's position that one of the officers they recognize, and I believe it's McMillan, that got involved in part of the fracas and trying to restrain our clients, one or the other of our clients.
Now, Sean Carroll and Edward McMillan are the two officers who fired the most shots a few hours later at Amadou Diallo, 16 shots apiece. So you have, now McMillan was part of the backup squad?
That's correct.
In this case, in the case
yes.
of Antoine and Maurice.
Yes.
So
and,
what happened then?
And basically, at that time, they didn't know who these people were. It was only the next day or the day after when photographs came out in the press that they recognized McMillan as one of the ones who got involved in restraining them. Or restrained at least my client.
Now, Jose, I was in the courtroom when McMillan and Carroll on Monday detailed what they were doing on that shift. They got on the shift at 9 p.m. that evening at Randall's Island. They were then, after doing some paperwork, called to assist an incident that was in progress on Boynton Avenue around 10 p.m.
Right.
But they indicated in their testimony that they played almost no role except to, as Carroll said, he was asked by a supervisor to walk up and down the street and look for some evidence. I think it was a possible a gun that had been discarded, and he just found nothing and then was told that he and his crew of three fellow officers could leave the scene. Now, you're saying that that according to your clients, they were a lot more active in that Boynton Avenue incident
yes.
than they testified at trial.
Yes. Yes, and we shared that information, at least Mr. Antoine Washington and his attorney, Rudy Velez, shared that information with ADA Carroll, which they met. He wanted to meet with me and my client, and I said, look, I'll be quite honest with you. I don't feel comfortable you know, speaking with my client if you're not going to drop these baseless charges that have been launched against him. Because
well,
his brother, who they went after and held for 30 hours, they released him.
Well, let's take this a step at a time. So they
my client.
Right. So they attacked Antoine when he was walking down the street?
As he entered up.
Right, as he was going into his house.
They didn't want him to enter the house. He says, I live here. That's my brother. He's yelling, screaming. So he ran up into the area, and they attacked him.
And Maurice was the one who was originally walking down the street.
No. That's correct.
Okay, so they're now all there. What happens? Do both Antoine, the brother who ran up after, and Maurice get arrested?
Both of them get arrested. My client actually gets charged and arraigned for resisting arrest and assault on an officer, that sort of thing. And his brother, who they tried to find evidence. They tried to find marijuana. They tried to find guns. All he had was a cell phone. And he happens to be black. And that's basically why they stopped him.
So they're arrested.
There was no other reason. He didn't look like a rapist or anyone else. They just decided, let's stop this guy in the corner. We don't like the way he's walking or looking or whatever.
How long did they hold him for?
Well, they held the first brother, Antoine, for 30 hours, and then they released him. my client spend the night in jail, and then he was arraigned.
So they released the young man who they had followed to his house?
Right.
After 30 hours, but 30 hours they held him?
That's right.
And what did they charge Maurice with, your client?
They charged him with resisting arrest and assault, if I'm not mistaken, and the traditional obstruction of governmental administration, something like that.
Assaulting who?
One of the police officers claims that he fell down the stairs.
Which one?
You know, I would have to look. I don't have my file with me, Amy, but it's one of them. It's not. It's one of the first group of officers. Mm-hmm.
And Maurice has no doubt that it was MacMillan who was involved in doing precisely what?
Part of the restraining, holding him down. You know, they got especially his brother got hit pretty good. They both had to go to the hospital.
Now, this brings us to a number of really interesting issues that police departments and people who are victims of police abuse go through around the country, and that is when a case is brought to the DA's office. A lot of people right now are frustrated with the prosecution of the four police officers, saying they're just not being aggressive about it. And others are saying, well, maybe it's because they work with police all the time and they don't want to wreck their relationship with the police. So you bring this case to the Bronx DA, and they don't take it up as part of the Amadou Diallo case.
Right. In fact, ADA Carroll, and I spoke with him, he basically shared with me, and he said, you know, and I thought we should have brought charges against Antoine, the first brother. And I was very surprised at that kind of response in light of, you know, like if they did something wrong. And he was very insensitive. And it was based upon that I said it would be a waste of my time to bring my client to him. I said, all he's looking for is to get evidence against my client. If I had a sense that he was trying to be fair and was trying to search for the truth, I would have considered bringing my client in. But I knew that his attitude was one of, and he shared it with me, that these guys did something wrong. What, I don't know, but they did something wrong, and the other one shouldn't have been let off easy.
So he's working with the police, like MacMillan, and prosecuting your client, and that raises questions. At the same time, they are prosecuting MacMillan.
That's correct. They did an investigation, and nothing came of it. We haven't heard anything from the DA's office. All we're doing is fighting for my client's freedom, and we sued the city for the violation of civil rights.
And Maurice has yet to come to trial on his charges.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
Well, it is amazing that if the district attorney had the opportunity to get more information on perhaps the biggest case that that Bronx District Attorney Robert Johnson's office has ever had, merely by offering immunity from any prosecution to both Maurice and Antoine Washington, that they would not do that, at least to get some sense of what those officers were doing the night that is now going to be forever ingrained in the history of New York City, the night that they shot Amadou Diallo.
This happened like an hour and a half beforehand. You know, they were already, in our opinion, from what our clients tell us, they were already riled up. You know, it's like, you know, a smell of fresh meat, you know, for a shark. You know, they were already, the adrenaline was already going, and they went in this kind of psychological state. I mean, that's how I saw it.
Speaking about smells of things, my colleague Bernard White has been raising this issue a lot in these hours leading up to the shooting of Amadou Diallo, is the state of these four officers. All sorts of questions. For example, were they tested for drugs, for alcohol? Juan, you've raised this question also. People should understand around the country that in New York there's a 48-hour rule, one of the only places in the country where the cops cannot be questioned, cannot be touched, they're not tested. in that first 48-hour period. And so we don't know what their state was, and we haven't heard the prosecution ask. We're going to break for stations to identify themselves, but then we'd like to come back with you for just a minute. I know you have to leave, Jose Muniz, and we should say that he's involved with another very significant case that people around the country are hearing about. We'll talk about that in a second, just to mention it. But this is Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds.
My condolences to Mr. and Mrs. Diallo and family.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Jose Muniz, who is an attorney who is representing a young man who was attacked by the street crimes unit in the Bronx in his home just hours before Diallo was killed. And it appears that the backup unit of the two street crimes units who approached Antoine and Maurice Washington, the backup unit, was the unit that ended up killing Amadou Diallo. We just haven't heard about this story before.
Yes, one of the things, as Amy was saying before the break, this whole issue of officers who are involved in shootings, even if a shooting is an accident, I know that, for instance, in New York City, any bus driver, any train conductor who is involved in an accident must automatically be tested for drugs and alcohol in his system, with the possibility that something might have impaired his judgment. Even if you subscribe to the viewpoint that these four officers were involved in a tragic accident, the New York Police Department is not required to test its officers who are involved in shootings for drugs or alcohol. And the reality is that that these officers were out in plain clothes in an unmarked car, unsupervised, for hours in a night shift. And it's not unknown for officers to, while on duty, to stop in and have a drink someplace or to relax out of the sight of supervisors. And I'm not saying that these four officers did that, but I'm saying that in these kinds of accidents, it would seem that the city should require officers, all officers, to be tested for drugs and alcohol whenever they're involved in any kind of a shooting that that injures another civilian.
Jose Muniz.
Yes, I agree. The 48-hour rule, and, you know, it's a tragic situation because it allows the police to basically synchronize their stories, an ability to, you know, plan out how they're going to present what happened. In other words, to develop a story that is going to be consistent with the victim actually being the aggressor or doing something wrong. And, you know, it's the union, the PBA union is a very powerful union, and basically they fought changing that rule, and our current mayor backs up that 48-hour rule. So if we could get rid of that rule, believe you me, a lot more, you know, proper investigatory work can be done when something like this happens, an accident. Because even if you look at the best light for the police officers, it was an accident. And really, if it's an accident, then we want to know how it happened, why it happened.
Jose Muniz, we're going to have to interrupt. We're going to have to interrupt because the trial this morning is beginning, and we're going to go live to the trial. We're going to thank you very much for being with us, Attorney Jose Muniz. And we're going to follow up this case. We're going to go now to State Supreme Court Judge. Teresi, talking about a juror speaking with a reporter.
However, Mr. Michaels told me that they have had a person checking on jurors' names and addresses, and that he did not think that that person had gone this far. Those are his words. I think everybody can take their own conclusions from that. He has assured me, that is Mr. Michaels, that he would have a talk with the person who was conducting this work on behalf of the Times Union. I feel that this is not an impairment of this trial. I feel the trial can go forward and the jury can be fair and impartial. However, I am very aware of the fact that there is much competition between the media out there, not only in this room here, but downstairs and on the street. And this is particularly true in view of the fact that television has now entered into this courtroom and that the public in general does not rely upon the print media. The public in general can sit at home and watch this trial, see exactly what occurs, and does not have to rely on the print media. I caution those in the media in general, and again, this is not an accusation, that you have a responsibility not only to the public to print what occurs, but also a responsibility to see to it that this trial is not impaired at all. I would certainly hate to have to bring these lawyers back on another occasion to go through this once again, or to have these defendants go through this trial once again. All right, that being said, bring the jury in, please.
New York State Supreme Court Judge Teresi talking about a juror, I guess, speaking with a reporter, but saying he's not going to dismiss the jury at this point, and they're bringing the jury in now for the trial of the four New York City police officers charged with the murder of Amadou Diallo. You were there, Juan, in the midst of all of this. What was the scene there?
Well, given the notoriety of this trial and other high-profile trials I've attended in the past, it was not as chaotic as I thought. It's actually pretty well organized. Of course, there's a tremendous security around the courthouse, and it's hard to get into the courthouse without you've got to go through a couple of metal detectors, one downstairs and one upstairs outside the courtroom, and passes as well to be able to get into the courtroom. Teresi has actually run the trial in a very almost military-like fashion. Everyone is amazed at how quickly the trial is moving forward. So I think it has not been a circus at all, as has occurred, for instance, in big trials like the O.J. trial or some other major trials around the country. And part of it is also that being in Albany, it's not a whole lot of pressure up there. I mean, there's much more than Albany would normally have. But the courtroom is very small, so not very many people can get in.
You know, what about the effect, and this is what people are very concerned about, you know that if it was in the Bronx, there would be 1,000 people outside every day. What has happened in Albany?
Well, there's been a substantial, a regular crowd of people who go up every day from New York City, but it has not been huge in number. As I said, and the security around the courthouse is pretty strong, so that people cannot get. It's about a block. Within a block, you can get as close as you can to the courthouse. So that it hasn't been the type of situation where demonstrations could have any impact on what's going on or even be heard inside the courtroom.
There are so many questions about what's going on inside the courtroom now and why the prosecution isn't pursuing this case in the kind of aggressive way that people expected. Can you talk about some of the issues, Juan, that you were concerned about? For example, who's even doing the cross-examination? The four cops are speaking for the first time, and these guys are hearing it, the prosecution, for the first time.
Well, I was kind of surprised that Eric Warner, who is the senior litigator in the entire Bronx District Attorney's Office. He's the chief, I think, executive assistant in the Bronx District Attorney's Office. That Warner, who was directing the team of lawyers, did not do the actual questioning of the of the police officers, but in essence assigned it to Don Levin, who, while he's an experienced prosecutor, I found him, I think, my sense was that his method of continually harping on particular issues with the officers, like how loudly they were they yelled the commands that they say they issue to Amadou Diallo, that I think that that tended, my sense was that it was turning off the jury, that the prosecutor was not winning any points with the juries. It continued to harp on the issue of how loud were you screaming or barking your commands to Amadou Diallo. And I felt that there were key areas where he did not really go after the contradictions in the testimony of the officers that he could have pursued much more strenuously.
Juan, we're going to go back to the courtroom where the first witness has just sat down.
New York City Police Department.
And how long have you been a member of the New York City Police Department?
18 years.
And what is your current rank?
Police officer.
Officer Barrow, what is your current assignment right now?
I work for an emergency services unit, K-9.
Okay, and briefly, what are your duties in that department?
Excuse me, sir?
What are your duties in that department?
This is Officer Michael Barrow.
Okay. Now, let me take you back to February 4th, 1999. What was your assignment at that time?
I was to cover East 138th Street, the Westchester Square, on the number 6 train.
And what,
Yes, it was a transit assignment.
All right, officer, I'm going to ask you to talk a little slower and much louder, okay? Please talk as if you're talking to the people in the back of the courtroom.
Okay.
Then everyone will hear you, okay?
Okay.
All right.
What tour of duty were you doing at that time?
10 o'clock at night to 6:30 in the morning.
And what county were you in at that time?
Bronx.
Officer Barrow, please tell us where you were at approximately 12:40 a.m. on the morning of February 4th, 1999.
I was at Soundview Avenue and Westchester Avenue.
And did there come a time when you responded to a location at Wheeler Avenue?
Yes, there was.
And how did you come to be at that location?
Excuse me, sir?
How did you come to be at that location?
Through a radio transmission.
Okay. And where did you go, officer?
To Wheeler Avenue and Westchester.
Okay. Was any particular location or address that you arrived at?
1157 Wheeler Avenue.
Now, officer, what time did you arrive at that location?
At approximately 12:45 a.m.
And upon arrival, officer, what, if anything, did you do?
I exited my vehicle.
And upon exiting your vehicle, where did you go and what did you do?
I started walking down towards 1157 Willow Avenue when I saw a lieutenant, uniformed lieutenant from the 4-3 precinct.
Did you know who that lieutenant was?
No, I don't know the name.
Did you have a conversation with him?
Yes, I did.
And based on that conversation, what, if anything, did you do?
I had asked him if any officers were injured.
And after that, what did you do, officer?
I had asked him if there were any outstanding suspects.
Now, Officer Barrow, did there come a time when you had occasion to look into the vestibule at 1157 Wheeler Avenue?
Yes, there was.
And if you could tell us, what time did that occasion occur?
At approximately 1 o'clock in the morning.
And when you looked into 1157 Wheeler Avenue, please tell us where you were.
I was on the top step looking in.
Tell us, officer, what, if anything, did you observe at that time?
At the time, I observed a body face up. To right of him, I observed a wallet and a beeper.
Please tell us what the lighting conditions were.
They were dim at the time.
Did you have a flashlight with you?
Yes, I did.
Did you have to use your flashlight?
Yes, I did.
How long did you look into the vestibule?
Approximately 30 seconds.
Thank you, officer. I have no other questions.
Mr. Patton, do you have any direct examination?
No direct examination.
You're listening to Michael Barrow, who is a police officer who came on the scene, one of the first ones right after the shooting of Amadou Diallo.
Did you take a particular note of which lights were on and which lights were off? At that vestibule?
No, I did not.
Rephrase it, okay? Sustain.
Can you tell us where the lights were located at 1157?
No, I cannot.
Can you tell us which lights, if any, were on and which lights were off?
No,
defense
sir.
Attorney Stephen Wirth. He represents Edward McMillan.
Based on an impression of what you recall, the lights.
Yes, sir.
Today. Nothing further.
Mr. Culleton, do you have any direct examination?
I do not, Your Honor.
Cross-examination, please.
Yes.
This police officer is now going to be cross-examined by the prosecution, who is, they are conferring with each other right now. They're saying they have no questions. They have no questions. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we are getting this live feed from the courtroom courtesy of Court TV, and we thank them for that. Again, this is a case that is going at lightning speed. Juan, there is this sense in the first 2 days, the jury chosen, people sat down. This judge has a very tight grip on this trial. They are now going to bring up another witness. A defense attorney has just come up to the podium.
That's John Patton, the defense attorney for Sean Carroll.
They're seating the witness right now. Again, we are now in the day after the four police officers have each given their testimony. The prosecutors only asked about 20 minutes of questions each for the four police officers. Here we go. We are now looking at the courtroom as the defense attorney prepares to move forward. Juan, just as they consult with each other, these issues raised about the kinds of questions that haven't been asked. The witness right now is being sworn in, and he is walking. It's another police officer.
P-A-T-E-L-L-I, duly sworn.
This is Officer Patelli.
Good morning, Sergeant Patelli. My name is John Patton. I represent Police Officer Sean Carroll.
Good morning.
Sergeant, how many years have you been on the New York City Police Department?
July will be 13 years.
And what is your present assignment?
Bronx Street Crime Unit.
How many years have you been in the Bronx Street Crime Unit?
Approximately 2 years.
Do you know these gentlemen who are on trial here?
Yes, I do.
Now, how many, which you're on? I noticed that you're a sergeant. When did you make sergeant?
I was promoted in December of 1995.
Now, I call your attention to the night or early morning hours of February the 4th, 1999. Do you recall that day and that evening?
Yes, I do.
Where were you working, Sergeant?
In the Bronx, the confines of the 43rd Precinct.
Were you in uniform or plain clothes?
Plain clothes.
Did there come a time that you were called to a location on 1157 Wheeler Avenue?
Yes.
Can you tell us about that call, please?
While we were at the corner of Westchester and White Plains Road, we received a urgent radio transmission saying, I need a boss and a bus to 1157 Wheeler Avenue.
And you heard that transmission?
Yes, I did.
Did you recognize who was on the air at that point?
I can't say for sure.
Okay, but that's what you heard?
Yes.
Did you then respond to that?
Yes, I did.
What did you do?
We responded. I arrived at the scene in approximately a minute, at which time I exited the radio car, and I approached Police Officer Boss, who I saw leaning on a car. He was apparently, he was pale white. His eyes were red and tear-welled. He was staring at the space. I asked him, Kenny, you all right? He just shook his head, motioning yes, and I continued running down the street.
Now, can you tell us, in what approximate location did you see Officer Boss? Where was that in relation to, say, 1157?
It was more towards Westchester Avenue.
And he was leaning up or sitting on a car, is that correct?
He was leaning on a parked car.
All right. Now, having had that conversation with Police Officer Boss, you then continued towards the address of 1157?
Yes, I ran up Wheeler Avenue, and I asked two questions while I was running up Wheeler Avenue. The first question I asked is, are any of us hit? I got an answer of no. The second question I asked, are we looking for any perps? And I got an answer of no. There's a person down in the building.
Now, you had that conversation with whom?
I don't know exactly who answered. I saw a lieutenant on the scene. I can only suppose that it was Lieutenant Cantwell.
It's your recollection it was Cantwell?
I don't recall exactly who answered the question.
Okay. Did there come a time, sir, when you looked into the vestibule at 1157 Wheeler Avenue?
Yes.
Can you describe the lighting conditions for us, please?
It was dimly lit. The lighting was poor, to the best of my recollection.
Now, how long were you looking into that vestibule? Do you recall?
A few seconds. I ran into the vestibule. I ran up to the vestibule and ran in.
You were in the vestibule?
Yes.
When you got into the vestibule, who was there?
Officer Carroll.
And can you describe what you observed when you saw Officer Carroll in that vestibule?
He was hunched over. Mr. Diallo was lying face up at the time, crying, rendering what appeared to be medical aid. I didn't see any chest compressions or anything, but I think he was trying to feel for a pulse or get close to his face to see if he had any breath coming out of his mouth.
And did you have any recollection of anything that Officer Carroll may have said at that point?
Excuse me, could you...
Do you recall what, if anything, Officer Carroll was saying at that point?
I don't recall exactly what he was saying. If I was to guess, I would say I thought he was...
Sustained. Just your recollection, that's all we want.
I don't recall exactly what he was saying.
Okay, but he was leaning over the body, is that right?
Yes.
And he was administering some kind of aid to the person.
It's leading.
Yes, sir. Aid. Could you describe again for us what you observed, please?
Sustain.
Now, did there come a time where
you're
police
listening
officer
to
Carroll
Pacifica
got up
Radio's
from the body?
Democracy Now. This is Democracy Now! As we bring you live the trial of the four New York City police officers charged with the murder of Amadou Diallo. This is Sergeant Robert Patelli. He is a defense witness. We'll come back to him in just a minute.
My condolences to Mr. and Mrs. Diallo and family.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we rejoin the trial live in Albany, New York, of the four officers who are charged with murdering Amadou Diallo, a young man who was shot with 41 bullets last February 4th, 1999. Right now, Sergeant Robert Patelli is on the stand, one of the first officers to get to the scene after Amadou Diallo was killed. He's describing Sean Carroll, who is the officer who he says was with Amadou Diallo as he died.
I don't recall if Lieutenant Cantwell walked Officer Carroll down the block, but I know that he was walking in a direction towards Westchester Avenue.
Did there come a point where you saw Officer McMillan and Officer Murphy?
When the bus responded and uniformed personnel started to respond, I left from the front of 1157 Wheeler Avenue and walked down Wheeler Avenue towards Westchester Avenue where my car was to see if Lieutenant Cantwell needed any assistance.
And did you see the officers then down at Westchester Avenue?
Yes.
Who did you see?
I saw the four officers involved, Police Officer McMillan, Police Officer Carroll, Police Officer Boss, and Police Officer Murphy. They were at the back of my radio car, and Lieutenant Cantwell was apparently... doing an ammo check, checking their magazines.
Did there come a time that they got into your vehicle?
Yes.
And where did you go?
Westchester Square Hospital.
Now, one or two questions. Do you recall whether there was a light outside 1157 Wheeler Avenue?
I don't recall a light being outside 1157 Wheeler Avenue.
Do you recall whether there was a light in the vestibule, 1157 Wheeler?
There was a light in the vestibule.
Would you describe for us the lighting, please?
It was dimly lit.
Was it as bright as this room?
No.
Overruled.
No, nowhere near as bright as this room.
It's your distinct recollection it was dim. Is that right?
Sustained. Leading.
No further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Worth, do you have any direct?
No, you don't.
Mr. Culleton?
Just a question or two. Good morning, Sergeant. My name is James Culleton. I represent Richard Murphy. You mentioned the name Lieutenant Cantwell. Do you know Lieutenant Cantwell? Or did
yes.
you know him prior to February 4th, 1999?
Yes.
To the best of your recollection, did you arrive before or after Lieutenant Cantwell?
I arrived after Lieutenant Cantwell. I was the second car on the scene.
Now, when you went to 1157 and went inside the vestibule, at any time did you see any of the four officers south of the vestibule, in other words, towards Watson Avenue?
No.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Bronstein, direct cross-examination.
Prosecution now standing up to question one of these first officers on the scene, Sergeant Robert Pertelli, who brought the officers to the hospital after the shooting of Amadou Diallo. You are listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy.
We've met before, right?
Yes.
A couple of times, last February and March?
Yes.
Sergeant Pertelli, why were you up in the 4-3 precinct that morning?
It was our first night in the 43rd precinct. They had an increase in violent felony crimes is usually the reason we go to another precinct. My particular team was focusing our attention towards a Bronx robbery, taxi livery robbery pattern in the vicinity of the Bronx River houses.
Okay. That was your assignment in your car to be in that location for taxi livery problems?
Well, it was our first night in the 43rd precinct. The Lieutenant Cantwell was going to have an in-depth meeting with the CO of, I don't know if it was the housing CO or the CO of the 43rd precinct to see where their particular problems were, and then we were going to respond to that. But the only thing I knew was the taxi unit was already in the 43rd precinct addressing a taxi livery robbery pattern.
Sergeant Pertelli, had you seen any of the four police officers here today prior to arriving at 1157 Wheeler Avenue that night?
No.
Had you been present at Boynton Avenue for an incident that occurred at approximately 11 o'clock that evening?
I understand the objection. I'm going to overrule it.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Had you seen either of the four police officers here today earlier that evening at Boynton Avenue?
I don't recall seeing them at Boynton Avenue. I was at Boynton Avenue.
I'm sorry, you were there?
I was there.
Okay. Had you had any contact with either of the four officers at all that night?
Not prior to the shooting incident, no.
Okay. When you arrived in Wheeler Avenue, what type of car were you in?
I was in a 1990 box, unmarked blue Chevy, Caprice Classic.
And how many other officers were in the car with you?
Three plus myself.
Okay. And when you got out on Wheeler Avenue, was that in the vicinity of around 1162 Wheeler Avenue?
I don't recall exactly where I exited the car.
Was it north of 1157 Wheeler Avenue, more up towards Westchester?
Yes.
And that's where you parked your car?
I didn't park the car. Police Officer Dixon was operating the vehicle.
And when you exited the car, you say you went over to Police Officer Boss, who was leaning on a car, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Did your other fellow police officers exit the car also?
Yes, they all exited the car.
Okay. So it would have been the four of you plus Police Officer Boss in that general area.
I don't recall us all being together. I think Police Officer Dixon stayed in the car. I don't recall us all being together for that long. It was a quick thing. It was just seeing if he was all right and running down the street to see if there was anybody else that was hurt.
And you were all in plain clothes, correct?
Yes.
And as you went down the street and arrived at 1157 Wheeler Avenue, did you notice any type of ballistics evidence on the ground?
Yes, I did.
What did you see?
In front of 1157 Wheeler Avenue, there was numerous shell casings.
And did you make any attempt at that point to preserve that scene with the shell casings?
Yes, I did.
What'd you do, if anything?
I directed Police Officer Smith, who was behind me, to go to the rear of my car where I had to roll the tape and start roping off the area.
And the reason for doing that was what?
To preserve the scene.
Okay, and you wanted to make sure nobody would step on the shells or any other evidence, correct?
To the best of our abilities, yes.
You say there came a time you went into the vestibule at 1157 and saw Police Officer Carroll, correct?
Yes.
What was his position in regards to Mr. Diallo?
He was to the right of Mr. Diallo, hunched over him, kneeling.
So would that have made him closer to you as you walked in the vestibule or on the other side of Mr. Diallo?
Probably closer to me.
What part of Police Officer Carroll could you see as you entered the vestibule?
His back.
And when you entered the vestibule, were you able to see the condition of Mr. Diallo?
Yes.
What were you able to notice about him?
He was lying face up, and he was apparently dead when I got there.
How could you tell that? What things did you observe?
His eyes were glassy and half open. I've seen that look before, and I'm not a medical expert, but I was almost 100% sure he was dead at that time.
So you're able to see his face?
Yes.
Okay, were you able to see his body? Did you notice any injury to his body?
I wasn't able to see his body, no.
Why was that?
He was wearing clothes.
Okay. And Police Officer Carroll, you said, was in the vestibule. What about Lieutenant Cantwell? Where was he?
Lieutenant Cantwell was in the vestibule with me at one time. I don't know if he walked in after me or before me. I really don't.
But you say you were the one who tapped Police Officer Carroll on the shoulder and tell him to come with you.
Yes, I did.
Okay. You mentioned that Police Officer Carroll was crying.
Yes.
What did you notice about his face?
When I saw his face, it was red. And he had tears on his face. His eyes were red and welled with tears.
And this is while you were in the vestibule that you saw that?
I don't think I remember seeing it in the vestibule. I think it was more on Westchester Avenue and Wheeler when I really got a good look at him.
And while you were in the vestibule, what other things did you notice inside the vestibule other than Mr. Diallo and Police Officer Carroll?
There was a wallet to the right of Mr. Diallo's body.
Anything else?
No, that's all I can recall.
Did you notice pieces of plaster on the floor or wood chips on the floor?
I was in there. I wasn't in the vestibule for a long period of time. It was quick, maybe 2 minute stops, and I don't even know if it was that long.
Okay. And you weren't using a flashlight inside the vestibule, right?
No, I wasn't.
And when you saw Mr. Diallo lying there, did you ever state that you observed the condition of a perp?
Objection.
Look around.
It's beyond the scope. It's irrelevant. It's assuming the fact that it's
sustained.
And when you left the vestibule area, you indicate that either yourself or Lieutenant Cantwell took Police Officer Carroll down the street?
I didn't take Officer Carroll down the street. I don't know who exactly did. And if I was to guess, it would be Lieutenant Cantwell did it.
Sergeant Patelli, you were one of the first supervisors on the scene, right?
Yes.
And it's your responsibility to maintain the integrity of the crime scene as one of the first supervisors there?
Yes.
And you've known these police officers for some time, correct?
No, I haven't.
Well, how do you know them?
You mean before today or before that day?
Thank you, Your Honor. Before February 4th of 1999.
No, I didn't know them too well before that date.
Had they ever done patrol with you?
Only one of them.
Which one was that?
Police Officer Boss.
Okay. And you've been in Street Crime Unit for how long?
It's almost 2 years. I'm coming on 2 years.
Are you familiar with the Street Crime Unit motto, "We are the night"?
Objection.
Sustain.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
This is John Patton, redirect. John Patton, who is the attorney for Sean Carroll. John Patton, by the way, represented one of the officers in the Abner Luina case, and he was acquitted.
You're on the 6-2 tour.
Yes, which in all actuality is 5:26 p.m., which would be February 3rd, 5:26 p.m., to 2:10 a.m. on February 4th.
Lieutenant Pucci's platoon is a different platoon, correct?
Yes, he's the late tour commander.
And what's their hour?
I don't know their hours for sure. If I was to guess, it would be, I think, 2100 to what would be 9 o'clock p.m. February 3rd to 6:30 a.m. February 4th.
And your platoon is addressing a certain specific crime pattern, correct?
Yes.
And was Pucci's addressing a different crime pattern, if you know?
Objection, Your Honor.
Overruled.
I don't know what crime pattern they were addressing, though.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you.
Mr.
That was John Patton. They're now asking Stephen Wirth. He says he has a few questions. Stephen Wirth is part of the law firm that represents the Patrolman's Benevolent Association.
I don't know for sure.
About?
When I was leaving, there was a lot of police personnel
15,
showing up.
15 or 20? Is leading.
Give us your best
estimate. I'm sorry.
I wasn't at the scene that long, probably maybe a total of 5 minutes or so. I could say there was probably about 15 police officers when I left.
Did you have a responsibility to take attendance of every cop who was present there?
You are listening to the live courtroom proceedings of the four New York City police officers who are charged with the murder of Amadou Diallo. They're charged with second-degree murder. We are wrapping up the national show. John Patton just finished asking questions. Again, he represented an officer in the Abner Luima torture case, and that officer was acquitted. Now, Stephen Wirth on redirect. Stephen Wirth, who is an attorney who is known for his 1995 acquittal of Officer Kenneth Goodman in the Morgue Boys corruption case, in which three officers were accused of violating the civil rights of Brooklyn residents and drug dealers, and his firm represents the PBA, the Patrolman's Benevolent Association. Juan, we just have a minute before the show is out. They did refer to the Boynton incident. Now, for listeners who tuned in at the beginning of today's program, that is what we were talking about with Attorney Jose Muniz, the incident that took place a few hours before the killing of Amadou Diallo, that Jose Muniz says his client, a young man, both the Washington brothers, were approached by and attacked by Street Crimes Unit with a backup that included the men who are now on trial for murdering Amadou Diallo. The sergeant who was just questioned said he didn't see those officers at Boynton.
Yes, and we're going to get more into that incident in the coming days to get more into why this has never come out at trial and why the district attorney's office didn't pursue it.
Clearly, the DA's office thinks there's something going on there because they have raised it a few times, but they have never explained why. So at this point, the jury would have no understanding of what was happening. Well, that does it for today's program. We want to thank Bernard White and Mimi Rosenberg. We were doing the show together before the national program on Pacifica Station WBAI when we learned of the Boynton incident, exactly what went down there. We will pursue that story tomorrow. We're also going to get more into the Street Crimes Unit and the kinds of arrests that are made. In terms of arresting white people, nine white people are stopped for every one arrested. When it comes to African Americans, 16 are stopped for every one arrested. And we're going to be looking at the Los Angeles Police Department daily. There are mass revelations about corruption and brutality within the Ramparts Division of the LAPD. So that does it for the program. Maria Carrion and David Love are our producers. Errol Maitland is our technical director. If you'd like to email us, you can call us you can email us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. And you can leave a message on our voicemail. What do you think of the trial and how do you like hearing it in these few days before it wraps up? The number to call is 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Cortez, all of the towering artists who knew that they owed a tremendous debt to Paul Robeson. It's very interesting at that.